Okay, basically this is a continuation of my first lecture. We're just going to consider a variety of topics. This is not entirely inclusive of everything. There's not that much time around, and it's just an overview. I'm not going to go into depth with a lot of things, but I want to give you just enough superficial information about a variety of topics that if you run into some of these things that you may never have seen before, that you'll at least remember you've heard about them and know where to go look it up. A lot of these things were very, very common when I first started practice in the U.S., and they've become so uncommon now that medical students coming out may have heard of them in medical school, but may never see them in the several years of practice. But some of them are resurging even in this country. So we're going to go over some fairly common things. Basically, I think I'll start with fluid therapy. You need to know a little bit of basic fluids, because that's going to be one thing you'll be using a lot in children. Normal maintenance therapy for infants and children. It says here 100 milligrams per kilo per 24 hours. I forgot to add that that's for the only first 10 kilos of body weight. For the next 10 kilos, you use 50 milliliters per kilo, and for all the rest, you use 25. Normal maintenance fluid. We use dilute solutions in children. The kidneys don't handle the normal saline too well for maintenance fluids over a long period of time, so we usually use someplace between 4 and 5% dextrose and 0.2 to 0.5 normal saline. There's a lot of variety, though. Infants' kidneys are pretty good. For mild dehydration, you add 25 milliliters per kilo for 24 hours. For moderate dehydration, 50, and for severe dehydration, 100. You usually give a bolus with severe dehydration. That we do use normal saline, a bolus of 20 or 30 milliliters per kilo of normal saline, and then we add to the maintenance fluids. If it's mild dehydration, 25 milliliters per kilo. If it's moderate dehydration, you use 50. If it's severe dehydration, 100. And then once you've done this and the child is out of shock, you switch to the normal maintenance. If it's possible, we try to follow electrolytes. Many of the mission hospitals do have laboratories that can do these quite accurately, but many of them don't. And you may be in a situation in some hospitals where a hematocrit may be the only lab test they can do. So you do what you can. But you do need to check hemoglobin hematocrit. It may be falsely high with dehydration. So if you see hematocrit or hemoglobin, say, of 6, by the time you rehydrate that child, you may get an actual hemoglobin of 3 or 4. If you can't find a vein, and a lot of these kids are in shock because of fluid loss or blood loss, you can't get an IV started. And I've seen people take, hours trying to get IV started. And in the meantime, of course, the child's not getting any fluids, things are getting worse, and everybody's getting frustrated. Well, there's an easy answer to that that people don't often think about. Do an intraosseous. Don't be afraid to do an IO. They're very simple, very easy to do. If you want a picture, there's a good one in the Harriet Lane Handbook for Pediatrics. And it's very simple. You just take a needle, you find the knee, there's a little flat part of the tibia just below the knee. You need a large bore needle, at least an 18, preferably a 16. A little bit of pressure and a twist, and you're right in there. You'll feel it pop in the bone. There's really almost no complications to these if you don't leave them in too long. You can do anything with an IO that you can do with an IV. You can put IV fluids in. You can put antibiotics in. You can use steroids, whatever you need. And it's quick and easy. Then you've got time to start your IV. You could take the next 24 hours to get an IV started. You don't want to leave an IO in too long. You don't want to risk bone infections and things of that sort. So the sooner you get an IV started, the sooner you can pull your IV, your IO out. When I was in Haiti and we were fighting cholera there, we had a tremendous number of dehydrated kids and even adults come in that we couldn't start IVs on. Never saw so many IOs done. It was amazing, though, that a lot of the doctors even... Do we have some surgeons there, Lance? We might have. And they hadn't done IOs either, so we had to do a lot of teaching of IOs. But by the end of the cholera epidemic, I think everybody there knew how to do an intraosseous. If they're not vomiting, you can try to use ORS if they're not severely dehydrated. For the burn patient, there are many formulas. I think these two standard formulas have been in use for probably 50 or 60 years, are still probably as good as anything modern that's come up. I won't run through all of them. You can find those in almost any handbook. Parkland Hospital formula or the Brook Army formula. They're a little bit different, but they both accomplish the same thing. Okay, now let's get to some childhood diseases. This is what I made my income on for the first 10 or 15 years in practice. We saw hundreds and hundreds of children with these type of things. Today, you don't see any unless you get a little outbreak. But unfortunately, they are resurging. There are a lot of people that, for some reason, think immunizations cause problems like autism or something, and there are a lot of propaganda out, don't get your child immunized. So what's happening? The childhood diseases are coming back. But people don't realize that it wasn't too many years ago when there's a tremendous death rate from measles, polio, things of that sort, and that we've pretty well eliminated them, at least cut them down with these immunizations, and there really aren't those side effects to them. Smallpox, of course, has been eradicated from the world for that, and we don't need smallpox vaccinations anymore. Okay, there's a case of post-measles encephalitis. That kind of got out of order. I don't know how that got in there, but we're talking about measles. I didn't see this in the United States very much, but my first visit to Tenwick Hospital, we had a child come in with a post-measles encephalitis. A very severe disease. Mortality rate is, 80, 90%. Those that live have brain damage. This child lived. No, he didn't either. He died. I'm sorry. But it's a horrible thing. People don't realize that simple things like measles are killer diseases. Measles, the incubation periods, spread by contact. First symptoms start like a normal upper respiratory infection. After a few days, the fever gets much higher, can go up to 40 or above. That'd be about 104. You get a typical measles macular papular rash after 3 to 5 days. The total duration of the main course of measles is 7 to 10 days in an uncomplicated case. That's nice, but at least half of them are complicated cases. Risk of pneumonia is very high. It can be a measles pneumonia or a secondary bacterial pneumonia. The encephalitis is probably the most dreaded complication. There's no specific treatment, even in this country, for it. In this country, children have pretty good vitamin levels, but in Africa they don't. And vitamin A seems to be somewhat protective or help the child's immune systems a little, so we do give vitamin A. Supportive care. May need some fluids if the child's vomiting. Isolation, of course, to try to keep all the other kids around it from getting it. This is a real problem in Africa. You've got one great big pediatric ward. You bring in a kid with measles, you've exposed every other kid in the ward to the measles. You may have one or two isolation rooms if you're lucky. So you really got to find some way to keep this from spreading around, and that's a real problem. You can prevent measles if you give immune globulin to siblings within a few days of exposure, but once you get by the first few days, it really doesn't work too well. The big problem is that measles vaccines are not given too well in the third world. In the immunization schedules, which I'll show you at the end of the lecture, it is recommended that they get a measles vaccine at about 8 months of age, which is too early to really give a permanent lifetime immunity. They should have a booster again after a few years, and they should have a third booster at age 10 to 12. But they rarely get those second boosters, even if they get the first one. So you really don't have good measles protection. Mumps, this is kind of interesting because 3 times now I've stopped a child on the way to the operating room for mumps. Mumps is a nice looking tumor in the side of the face. Well, it isn't a tumor. It's an infection of the parotid gland. It's a viral infection. It's self-limited. Really isn't very serious. But the real problem is keeping somebody from thinking it's a tumor. Looks a little like a Burkitt's lymphoma once in a while, and somebody wants to take them in the operating room and excise it or biopsy it. And I've had to stop 3 of those. I'm sure there are a lot of them that have been taken. But mumps isn't recognized too often. It's an easy thing to diagnose. A tumor is going to be a lot more firm. This is more tender. Most tumors are not that painful. And it goes from where the parotid gland is, the side of the face, down over the angle of the jaw into the neck. It can be on one side, can be on both sides. You can have other glands involved. In fact, any gland in the body can be involved with mumps, although it's rare. Orchitis can occur, doesn't cause any problems. Used to think it'd make people sterile, but it really doesn't, and it's not a problem. Meningitis from mumps does occur. However, it's a very benign meningitis, doesn't require any treatment, and there's about 100% recovery from it. Encephalitis, on the other hand, is more serious. It's more rare, but it does cause a sclerosing brain damage. Rubella or German measles probably wouldn't be recognized in Africa too easily because it's a very faint rash. The child isn't very sick. You might have a slight fever or not even recognize the fever, and it's gone in a day or two, and they don't really get very sick, so that you may miss it. Well, that's not a big problem in children, is it? Well, it is if you've got a mother, because German measles in pregnancy can cause severe congenital abnormalities, so that you've got to be very careful if you've got a case of German measles that we don't have any pregnant women around that you can spread it to. And German measles in pregnancy is very common cause of microcephaly, heart defects, and all sorts of severe problems. Again, no treatment, goes away by itself. But congenital rubella is a real problem. Severe anomalies, usually it's when the mother during the first trimester, because this is when all the major things, your heart and things, are being formed. So you get a tremendous amount of defects there at that time. It is recommended to terminate the pregnancy at that point. I don't believe that there's too much in the Bible that condones abortions, and I'm certainly as against them as anybody, but this is one circumstance where you might have to consider it. Erythema infectiosum, what we used to call fifth disease, a mild clinical disease. We used to call it slap cheek syndrome because it looks like somebody slapped their cheeks, nice red cheeks, a very faint rash, child who isn't very sick. Contagious as all dickens. If you've got a kindergartner with it that goes to school, probably everybody in his kindergarten class is going to have it in a few days. Again, a very supposedly harmless disease. Harmless except that once in a while there can be severe complications. There have been aplastic anemias. Thrombocytopenia is fairly common. And of course, it's more of a problem nowadays because when I first started practice, there was no HIV around. But right now, in an immunocompromised patient, you can have more difficulty. But if it occurs in pregnancy, here again is where the complications come. Not so much with the child, but with the mother who's pregnant. Fetal high drops can come. We didn't know the cause when I was in practice, but they found out since it's a parvovirus. Varicella zoster. Prior to the vaccine available, the primary infections resulted in chickenpox. And we didn't worry too much about chicken pox because it was great to get it over with as a child. Then you supposedly be immune for lifetime. Except, as you get older, if your immunity begins to wane, you can get herpes zoster. Well, it wasn't awfully common because most people got a fairly good permanent immunity from chicken pox. Now with a vaccine, we're pretty well putting off that. I don't know what the next 50 years are going to hold. We may find out more about it. But if the vaccine does tend to wear off in time, which often vaccines do, we may see an increase in the amount of zoster in older parents, older patients. Chickenpox, most characteristic is the rash. A rash develops over the first 3 to 5 days in different stages. We used to say that's the way you can tell it from smallpox, but there's no smallpox around anymore. Smallpox, everything is the same stage. Chickenpox is not. You see first a little papule that comes up, gets pretty itchy. By the time that's turned into a vesicle or a large bleb, well, you got a whole bunch more in the other stages coming up, and they're all in different stages. So that when you see a rash that looks like all different stages like that, then you think of chickenpox. Extremely itchy. Probably the most common complication of chickenpox is a secondary staphylococcal or streptococcal skin infection. Child scratching themselves all the time, and they infect those pretty much. So the basic treatment is just trying to prevent itching. Very simple. You sit them in a cool tub of water, let them stay in there all day, and fill it with oatmeal. If you can afford it and you got it in this country, we use Aveeno, which is a little easier than the oatmeal, but oatmeal's a lot cheaper and it works quite well. And a lot of anti-itch remedies, a lot of antihistamines. Fever, encephalitis is rare. I've seen a few encephalitises with chicken pox, but I think they all got well, but it can cause permanent brain damage. And the older children and adults get much more severe. So we always hoped our kids would get chicken pox when they're little. And I guess it's the wrong thing to do to expose people to disease, but I did it all the time. If mother had a child with chicken pox, I'd say, anybody else in your family, get them exposed now, get them early while they're young and get it over with, and they're immune for lifetime, and it's not so severe. Well, it's not a good practice to tell people to expose other people to illnesses, but we did do it. Fetal infection, that's the problem. Can lead to scarring of the limbs, even atrophy of limbs. Maternal infection in the last 5 days of pregnancy can lead to neonatal chickenpox, and that has a high mortality rate. And of course, it's so contagious that any close contacts will develop it. They've even cultured the chickenpox organism out of rooms a child's been in for a year after the child's been in the room. You can wash those walls down, you can scrub them, you can do anything in the world, and you'll still find a varicella virus someplace. Treatment we've gone over pretty well. Herpes zoster, we don't see it a lot in children. This is more of an adult disease. The children that get it, it's fairly mild. You usually don't need to treat it. Acyclovir, of course, is the treatment. It can ameliorate the course, but you have to give it in the first few days to be of any effect whatsoever. Usually it's not a child disease. Strep infection is probably the most undertreated and most serious of all of these childhood diseases. It's undertreated because many of them are asymptomatic. A lot of kids in school are strep carriers. In fact, if you do a study in school children in the wintertime, you'll find that probably half of the kids during the wintertime will be strep carriers and don't even know they have it. But you can still get complications of rheumatic fever and nephritis following an asymptomatic infection. So you can't treat something you don't know that you have. But it can be prevented. The general symptoms everybody is pretty well aware of. You get a sore throat. You get some fever, you feel sick. If you get a scarlet fever rash, which is a very fine scarlatiniform rash, why, it makes the diagnosis more obvious to you, and you probably can diagnose it without throat cultures. Over here, throat cultures can be done in less than 24 hours so that we obtain them pretty regularly. Unfortunately, in Africa, cultures are not very well attained. In fact, I'm not sure about how many hospitals have. I know Mike Gale said we're doing them at HBB in Togo now. I think they're probably doing them in Bangladesh because they had the same lab director there. I don't know about Tenwick or Kajabi, and I think when you get beyond that, I doubt if there are any mission hospitals that are doing cultures, so that you really have to do it clinically. But if you've got a sore throat, especially if you've got some swollen glands and the throat is fiery red, it's most likely going to be a strep, and you're better off over-treating. The occasional virus you're going to give penicillin to is worth preventing rheumatic fever by using it in a not using it in a strep. The tonsils can also have exudate over them too. It can look a little bit like infectious mono sometimes when you look at the tonsils. Okay. Occasional retropharyngeal abscess, and of course that's a true emergency. Retropharyngeal abscess can obstruct the breathing, and you really need to call in your ENT man or surgeon, or if you're the only one there, it's pretty hard to do it because you've got to have a little bit of skill to lance an in retropharyngeal abscess, but it does need surgical treatment. Okay, the other strep infections are mainly skin infections, impetigo or pyoderma. You can also get the same complications following those, though, that you can from a strep throat. It can affect almost any body organism. Toxic shock syndrome, we used to think it was all due to staphylococcal infections, but we know now that it can be either staph or strep, so you can't really tell without cultures. Treatment, and you can prevent rheumatic fever and most nephritis cases by 10 days of penicillin in any form. In Africa, it's probably better to give one injection of benzathine penicillin because you're not likely to get them to come to take their treatment. Once they feel better, they usually stop the medicine and don't finish the course, so you're safer with the long-acting penicillin. It's not always eradicated, but most of the complications are prevented, at least rheumatic fever is. Nephritis can still occur even with an adequately treated strep infection, and it occurs 6 to 10 weeks after the infection. There are other drugs you can use if you're allergic to penicillin. Clindamycin is not usually available in Africa, but erythromycin is. Okay, diphtheria, I've got this on there still, and I'm not sure I should probably take it out. I've never seen a case of diphtheria, but it is nice to know that it's a lot more severe than a strep throat. Child is really almost in shock. You've got thick membranes in the back of the throat which obstructs breathing. You've got to be prepared to do tracheostomy if you need it. I'm not sure I'd recognize a case right away, but maybe I would because it's worse than anything else you've seen. It's a bacterial infection, and of course has to be treated with antibiotics. Usually amoxicillin will work quite well for it. Incubation period is very short, but with good immunizations, it should be prevented. The problem is, even with good immunizations in Africa, they're not up to the standards that they are in the Western world, so that you can't always rely on immunizations. Treatment has to be started immediately because of the risk of obstructed breathing. If you have antitoxin available, that's the best thing to use. It's not always available. Antibiotic treatment right away. Erythromycin or penicillin in high doses for 14 days and be prepared to do a tracheostomy or intubate. Croup is a little more common. Croup can sound like a lot of other things, but if you've really heard it once or twice, why, that's pretty obvious. Croup is just what it sounds like. Child breathes out and tries to breathe in and goes like that, and there's not too many other sounds like that than croup. We usually felt that croup was fairly easy to take care of, but that's because I came along in the era of steroids. Well, before we knew that steroids were effective, an awful lot of kids ended up in the hospital with tracheostomies for croups, and there was a fairly high mortality rate. Nowadays, we know that even a small dose of steroids will reduce the swelling, at least to the point where the child won't obstruct and need a tracheostomy, and they recover pretty darn quickly. After the first day or so, the acute emergency is usually over. The main treatment is usually steam, either hot steam or cold steam, whichever you can get. If you've got hot water and a shower in the bathroom, why turn it on and let the child breathe in the steam. In the hospital, we used to put them in croup tents with cold steam. We'd blow the oxygen or air over ice and let them be in the cold steam, and it's actually more effective. But you've got to keep the kid warm. Okay. That says the same thing. Steroids can be very dramatic. I used to keep some of my patients at home that had recurrent croups. I'd keep the mother, have the mother keep some cortisone at home. Usually, even 5 milligrams of prednisone is often enough to abort the acute attack. And they wake up at 1 o'clock in the morning, and the drugstores are all closed. Epiglottitis can be confused with croup, and they can sound a little bit like it, but it's different in that the child is very sick. There's usually a high fever, which you don't see with croup. There's no fever with croup. It's a bacterial infection rather than a viral infection. And the child can't breathe quickly. It goes rapidly. The first day or two, the child can get to the point where they can obstruct. So you have to be careful and be ready to intubate them. It is susceptible to antibiotics, though. Typically, the child will be sitting and leaning forward to breathe. He knows how to stretch his trachea a little bit so he can get the air through. And that's about the only thing that's characteristic that's different from other diseases, except that they're a lot sicker. But you need to be prepared to do a tracheostomy. Do not examine the throat with a tongue blade. If you're at all suspicious it could be epiglottitis, and you put a tongue blade back there and touch the epiglottis with it, it can swell up and obstruct the breathing right away, and you may end up doing a tracheostomy just because you examined the child. So you can get a pretty good look without doing that. Lateral neck x-rays can show the swollen epiglottis. Rapid administration of antibiotics, oxygen, and IV fluids. Meningococcemia. This is very, very common in the third world. I've seen a little bit of it in the U.S., but not recently. But in the third world, I've seen quite a few cases of this, and they go rapidly. I just remember one tragic case in the outpatient department at Kajabi Hospital. They brought a small child in. They brought him immediately in. I think within the first 10 minutes, we had an IV going with high doses of antibiotics and steroids, and the kid died within 15 minutes afterwards. It can really go fast, so you can't wait around for a diagnosis. If you're suspicious of meningococcemia, don't wait for cultures or lab tests. Get your IV and your penicillin started, and then do your tests. And they can die very rapidly. It's a high fever usually, sudden onset. Pinpoint petechial rash can be very hemorrhagic later. You get shock and vascular collapse very quickly, and it's extremely contagious. Everybody that's been in close contact should have prophylaxis. There are several prophylaxis regimens that you can use. If you can't find the vein, again, think of an intraosseous. I always carry intraosseous needles with me. I've always got one in my pocket, because you never know when you're going to run into a situation like this where you don't have time to go to the lab and leaf through the drawers and try to find one. And sometimes that's not too easy to do. They go into shock quickly. You want to give normal saline for that quickly. They also get hypoglycemic. Massive doses of penicillin. Don't be afraid. There's no side effect from too much penicillin, but there is a lot of trouble from too little. Once you've treated them, if they get by the first 24 hours, they're going to live. And it only takes about 3 days. Actually, one of my professors once said 1 day is enough treatment, but I feel better with three. But it doesn't take a long treatment. 3 days of penicillin is enough. Prophylaxis to the family. We used to use rifampin all the time. We found now that Cipro is a lot easier. All you need is one dose of Cipro for everybody, 500 milligram tablet for adults and a half of one for the child. And the mortality rate is extremely high. Infectious mono can be confused with strep throat or tonsillitis. It's, again, a viral disease, so it's not sensitive to antibiotics. And it's such a varied spectrum of symptoms that you can have almost any kind of a clinical picture, and it can be infectious mono. But the basic thing is that you're very tired, very exhausted, and usually there's some pharyngeal symptoms that are typical. Glands are usually quite swollen in the neck. They get a lot bigger than they do with other bacterial infections. Typical membrane over the tonsils. That's a whitish membrane, whereas with tonsillitis, it's not quite as white. This is a thicker white membrane. Once you've seen tonsillitis and you've seen Epstein-Barr virus or mono, you can usually tell the difference after that just by looking at the throat. It's an exudative thing. You can get other things, hepatomegaly, splenomegaly. The characteristic is the atypical lymphocytes in the blood, so that very often just during a peripheral blood count can pretty well tip you that you've got infectious mono. You can also test for the Epstein-Barr virus. You can get a fine scarlatiniform rash and make you think it's a strep rash, but and amoxicillin 100%. If you give a patient with infectious mono amoxicillin, they'll all get the rash. There are very few complications, but they can be quite severe. The biggest problem is that you don't know the duration. Sometimes they get over it in a week or two. Sometimes it's 6 months to a year. My partner in practice, his son had to miss a whole year of college for infectious mono. It took him that long to get well. Complications you can see here, meningitis, encephalitis, Guillain-Barré syndrome. Occasionally agranulocytosis, cytosis, and other things. Splenic rupture occasionally. Burkitt's lymphoma. Now, in Africa, we see a lot of Burkitt's lymphoma. We don't see it so much over here. It's a typical picture of a swollen side of the jaw that looks a little bit like mumps, only it's a lot harder. Comes up fairly rapidly, and it seems to be associated with two other things. Epstein-Barr virus, previous infectious mononucleosis, but also malaria. And that's why we don't see it as much over in this country, because we don't have the malaria. But that combination of malaria, infectious mono, seems to lead to Burkitt's lymphoma a lot more commonly. Mike Gale can probably tell you more, but I'm not sure if they've really found out the reasons for those linkages, but we do know that that happens. Infectious mono, close personal contact is needed. It doesn't seem to be that contagious. You'll often see one case. But it can run in the family. You could see several in the same family. They do take a long incubation period, and I guess the reason we don't know how contagious it is the incubation period is so long that you've often forgotten who you were in contact with that long ago. But of course, it does spread where there's close contact, like boarding schools and colleges. It's more common in young children, but it's also milder. The older you get, the longer it lasts, and the more likely you are to have complications from it. The heterophile antibody test can do it. That's not readily available in Africa. And again, it's more of a clinical diagnosis then. Steroids will not cure it. You don't get well any quicker. But if you're having a lot of throat symptoms, they will reduce the swelling in the throat. So that we occasionally use those for a few days at the beginning. Acyclovir, I don't think it does any good. I put that it's undetermined to benefit, but I wrote that on there a while ago, and I think it's been pretty well proven it doesn't work. polio. We don't think much about polio anymore because everybody over here has gotten polio immunizations and we pretty well don't see it. Of course, I grew up with it. I had a scout camp canceled one year because so many kids had polio and couldn't go. But right now, it's pretty well gone. WHO has taken over the job of eliminating it like they did with smallpox, and they've been trying hard to do it. I think they're doing a good job, but it's not completely eliminated yet. I've still seen a few cases of it. In fact, I just saw two cases in Bolivia on the riverboat that Dan Thompson told you about. There were two people that had post-polio syndrome that came in while we were there. It's generally a minor illness in babies and small children. They rarely get any paralysis, and in the undeveloped countries, when polio was rampant, you rarely saw any paralytic polio. It was almost always a mild diarrhea. It was a viral illness. The kids got immune to it, and then they were immune when they were older. In the U.S., where we had more hygiene, and it wasn't as contagious, it wasn't so common in the young people. But as you went to school and other places where you could be exposed and got it, you're more susceptible to paralysis. And the older you get polio, the more likely you are to get the paralytic polio. So that at that point, it was good to let kids get it when they were little. Nowadays, we're trying to prevent them from getting it entirely. And I think eventually they will get that under control. It's just hard to get the whole world immunized. Asymptomatic meningitis occasionally caused by it. Paralysis is not very common, but when you've got a few million cases, why, that's a lot of paralysis. It's only from someplace between 0.1 and 2% have paralysis. The paralysis is fairly rapid and flaccid paralysis. It's not symmetrical, it's an asymmetrical type, and it can involve arms, legs, or anything. And of course, the most common, or not the most common, but the most serious problem is when it involves the respiratory muscles and you have to use artificial ventilation. We used to use the old things we called iron lungs. Of course, we've got a lot more modern ways of doing that nowadays. Cranial nerve involvement in respiratory muscles can occur. And even as much as 30 to 40 years later, adults can still develop more new symptoms from polio. Spread by a fecal-oral route. Perinatal transmission can occur. Incubation is short. Paralysis is a little bit longer, and the treatment is supportive only. Basically, warm baths, analgesics, physical therapy, respiratory care if necessary. Now, the recommended immunizations. In the United States, there's a good table that you can get. You can get it on the internet that's put out by the National Institutes of Health, and we get a lot of things. We get hepatitis at birth, and boosters, we get diphtheria, tetanus, pertussis vaccine, H-flu, IPV, MMRs, rotavirus, all these others as you can see. It's a great list, and it's really important. And if I can just drill one point at home, please have campaigns if you've got a community that's not getting their kids immunized, because measles is coming back. And we're going to have a lot of problems in this country if the trend that people are going through now. There are a lot of campaigns against vaccination, and they're all wrong. There have been many, many studies that show none of these things they're talking about are complications, and it's so important. The mortality rates from these diseases can be pretty high. Okay, in Africa, what do they get? Well, they get a BCG at birth, which we don't get. They do have these recommendations. But as you can see, the recommendations are much smaller. They don't get very many boosters as they go along, and a lot of these immunizations require boosters to become effective. And there are no vaccines given for rubella, mumps, pneumococcus, or meningococcus. Their measles vaccine is a plain measles vaccine, not the measles, mumps, and rubella that we give here. So that there's a lot that is left to be desired. Vitamin A is a deficient in most of these children in Africa, adults too, and it is recommended to give vitamin A. I think they rarely get it, but it's definitely can improve their immune system, especially resistance to measles. So that's a big area that we'd like to improve. Of course, vaccines have to be refrigerated, many of them, some of them don't, but there's a recent measles outbreak Paul just told me about a bunch of cases at Chitokoloki Hospital in Zambia. Evidently, their measles vaccine was not very potent and it didn't work, and they got a lot of cases of measles. Has to be refrigerated. When they first took measles vaccine over to Africa, nobody got any immunity from it. They didn't refrigerate it. It all went bad. So you do have to be careful your vaccines work. And I think my talk's a little shorter today. I didn't go into a lot of the big diseases over there because they all take a lot more time to go into, and you do need to have some talks on these, the sort of the big five that we call. They different times, different years, they say that a different disease is number one, but these generally over the years have been the most common severe problems that we fight. Gastroenteritis is a big killer. Protein energy malnutrition, that could take a couple of hours of lecturing. Malaria is probably the most common. TB and AIDS, and you're hearing some of those today as well. There are a lot of other things. I haven't covered all of these things. I could go on and on and on, but there's only so much time in the day, and I think we're done.
Okay. Thank you.